Grüezi miteinander, ganz herzlich willkommen an einem wunderschönen guten Tag, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren, liebe Freunde. Ich begrüße Sie zu einer Sondersendung von Weltwoche Daily, die andere Sicht, mit einem außerordentlich prominenten und sehr interessanten Gast. Das ist Professor Jeffrey Sachs. Er ist nicht zum ersten Mal in dieser Sendung und eine der ganz großen und wichtigen Stimmen in der Debatte über diese beunruhigenden Kriege, mit denen wir uns jetzt zu beschäftigen haben. Dear Professor Sachs, dear Jeffrey, very warm welcome in
Thank
our
you.
program. Thanks for your time. Let's jump in just straight ahead. How close are we now to the Third World War?
Close, unfortunately, I mean, alarmingly, because we have conflicts in three regions that are very serious. Of course, the hot war in Ukraine, which is with all potential for massive escalation. We have the conflict in the Middle East, where Israel is absolutely trying to make a wider Middle East war to draw the U.S. Into active war. And we have the potential for war in Northeast Asia, especially over Taiwan, between China and the United States. And for me, it's not a coincidence that we have these three fronts. I attribute them to the aggressiveness of U.S. foreign policy. I think really almost a delusional aggressiveness, a belief either in America's unipolarity and its dominance or a desire to maintain a dominance that is unachievable but is extraordinarily dangerous if pursued. So, in my view, the U.S., not coincidentally, is an active part of all three of these fronts. And they're all viewed on the U.S. side as a test of U.S. power. And that's very dangerous.
And what's the deeper reason, the root cause behind that? I mean, there are strong forces in the United States called isolationism. I mean, people who don't want these wars, and then they are the neocons and these people. What's the reason? Why is this happening right now? What's the reason within the United States for this behavior?
Broadly speaking, the permanent state, which means the military-industrial complex, the CIA, state that more or less transcends the visible politics, has been of an expansionist neoconservative persuasion since the end of the Soviet Union. The U.S. interpretation in December 1991 was, we won, you lost, we now run the world. The idea explicitly put, actually in many formal documents of the U.S., is that now the U.S. will maintain primacy or full spectrum dominance, so-called, meaning economic, financial, technological, and military in each region of the world, and be able to fight a two-front war or three-front war. Now, this manifested itself in a number of very specific policies in the European sphere. This manifested itself in the expansion of NATO after 1992. It's all ironic because NATO, of course, was a military alliance established to defend against the Soviet Union, which ceased to exist in December 1991. And indeed, Gorbachev explicitly disbanded the Warsaw Pact Alliance in 1990. Gorbachev said, let's cooperate, let's have peace. The United States said, oh, we get it, we won, you lost. And so the difference of point of view was that the US viewed Russia as a kind of pathetic, the phrase that was constantly used was a gas station with nuclear weapons, but that Russia was pathetic, it was on its knees. Now we can expand NATO. Of course, I think we've talked about it, and it should be widely understood that the US and Germany had explicitly promised Gorbachev and Yeltsin that NATO would not move one inch eastward in 1990. If people think that that is, pro-Putin propaganda, they should look at what's called the National Security Archive of George Washington University to get all the documentation. This was repeated time and again. Now, this is what happened in the European sphere: expand NATO to the east, get out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty, put in new anti-ballistic missiles in Central and Eastern Europe, notably in Poland and Romania to this point. Insist that the US can go wherever it wants in this alliance, up to and including the 2,100 kilometer Ukraine-Russia border, and including the Eastern Black Sea, which to my mind is mind-boggling to think that Georgia is a North Atlantic state that should be a member of NATO. Now, in the Asia-Pacific region, this was of lesser concern to American policymakers until around 2010, because the US just thought that China was a bunch of rice-growing villages, that it was poor, that it would assemble US iPhones and whatever, but that it was not of any significance. And it finally dawned on these geniuses in the US security state sometime around 2010 that China was becoming a great success economically and technologically. My view as an economist was a great success. Hooray! Good for the Chinese people, good for the world economy, good for global prosperity. But from a us versus them perspective, which I, of course, don't share, of the US security state, suddenly China became a dire threat. And starting around 2014, a new doctrine of containing China was adopted by the US officialdom. And this has transcended now Obama, Trump, and Biden. One basic point I should mention is that while the discourse is about Trump versus Biden or partisan politics, what we're observing in Europe, in the Middle East, and in East Asia is not partisan politics. It is a deep state US strategy. This is different. That's, by the way, not crazy conspiracy talk. That just means that there is a national strategy which transcends a particular administration. And we have these organizations, especially the CIA, the intelligence community, the Pentagon, the weapons contractors that have a time horizon that's longer term than a political cycle.
I just had a conversation with Matthias Döpfner. He's the chief of the Springer Company. He's at the board of directors of Netflix. He's the owner of Politico. And his newspapers are strongly advocating Western resistance towards Eastern despotism. I mean, we had a conversation about that. This is an argument you hear also in Switzerland. They say, well, China is a threat. They are undergoing, they're like evading the WTO rules. We have Russia, which is an autocracy. And there is a sense, and I think it's an authentic sense with these voices, that somehow our way of life, our democracy is threatened. Therefore, we have to contain for these countries, these powers. What are you? I'm sure you're confronted with this argument as well. What do you counter in this sense? What's your answer to that?
Well, first of all, it's a meme or a theme that goes back to Herodotus in the Greek Persian Wars. It's a theme since Alexander and the Hellenistic empires that he created. It is a theme of the Roman Empire in its battles with the Parthians, with the Persians, that went on for several centuries. It is a theme during the Crusades and the infidels to the East. It is a theme that was part and parcel of the rhetoric of the British Empire And it was a theme of the Enlightenment, Asian despotism, Western values. It's extraordinarily trite, is what it is. It is trite, it is simple-minded.
Is it paranoia?
It is ignorance, basically. People should go out and go to China, make some friends, have some Chinese students, go to Moscow, go to other places in the world. This us versus them mentality is kind of a primitive. Maybe it's a basic psychological state. Evolutionary biologists think that because small bands competed with each other over campsites and over foraging areas, that group solidarity and otherness of the other side is a fundamental theme. But the East-West theme is at least 2,400 years old. It's a little boring, and it's such a crude character. And when Biden came into office, of course, he's not a very intelligent person, even when he was younger. But he started, his whole foreign policy was the democracies versus the autocracies. I didn't know whether to put my thumb in my mouth and suck my thumb of how stupid this was, or how dangerous this kind of divide the world approach is. Turns out it's the latter. Biden meant it. He's absolutely dividing the world. He doesn't sit down to have conversations with anybody. We're great, they're evil. By the way, your friend at Springer, China's really going to endanger American way of life. Come on, are you kidding? What are you talking about?
Is there a sense, I think, is there a sense, an identity crisis here in the West? We have this woke philosophy that the questioning of everything, I mean, even of biology, then you have this kind of moral absolutism, not just in foreign affairs, but also in interior affairs, cancel culture. These could be read as symptoms of a severe identity crisis, which is somehow compensated by these pictures, by these kind of Dr. Strangelove way of looking at the world.
I think it's actually something a little bit different in my view, although there are many interpretations. But, in 1095, Pope Urban called for the First Crusade. This was Europe was pretty pathetic at that stage. It was peasants as serfs on manorial farms. But the idea was the crusade against the infidel, and a reconquest of the Holy Land, and all of that. And it started what was 1,000 years of Western ascendancy, looking back, and the idea that the West has the dominant moral, religious philosophy, that it should lead the world. And crusading became not only a literal series of wars, but it became an idea of the West, of spreading Western values, Western dominance, whatever those values were, African slavery, conquest, empire, whatever. Then, of course, the next phase was the voyages of Columbus and Vasco da Gama. Adam Smith, writing 275 years after that, said those were the two game changers of the world, because basically it became an interconnected but Western-led world. Then, with the industrialization of the 19th century, and with Darwinism, by the way, in its interpretations by social Darwinists, the idea was Europe is superior in power, it is superior in values, probably it's superior in genetics, became the new idea when the idea of evolution and genetics came at the beginning of the 20th century.
So you would say that this is kind of a superiority complex that is still raging within the West, if I
Yes,
understand correctly.
but with one major fact, which is that it's so flawed, so arrogant, and now we live in a multipolar world. The trick The great trick of Protestantism was teaching people how to read. And so literacy came early to Europe's north. That was a huge economic advantage, by the way. Huge! Probably the most significant thing was the printing press and Luther saying, read the Bible on your own, and Calvin saying, read the Bible. Suddenly, literacy. Okay, the rest of the world basically illiterate. One part of the world literate. And then saying, we're literate. We have advanced technology. We're superior. Oh, we're genetically superior. Oh, we're racially superior. So this became the idea. Now, all of it was a kind of a cruel nonsense, even in historical terms, because the other great civilizations were, well, duh, we've been here two for 3,000 years, sorry to tell you. And now we're really, truly at a moment where the United States can't get its way in Ukraine. The United States can't get its way in Taiwan. The United States can't get its way in the Middle East. The Arabs have woken up, by the way. They've been manipulated by the British Empire and by the French and by the American Empire for 100 years. They're saying, stop, no more, don't manipulate us. So what's happening is 1,000 years, or you could say since Herodotus, but basically 1,000 or 500 or 200 years, depending on when you want to date it, of perceived European superiority, what your counterpart, Springer, said, Western values. That's not just we have our values, that's our superiority is what's being expressed there. This is being challenged, understandably, properly, by the fact that there are other people in the world, thank you. And when I add up the vote count, as it were, the US has 335 million people. European Union has 450 million people. Add in Switzerland, add in Norway, add in Britain, and you get maybe to 900 million people. Add in, if you want, though it's kind of arbitrary, Japan, Korea, add in Australia, New Zealand. Maybe you get to 1 billion people. That's 12.5% of the world population. We're going to run the world? Come on.
Let's talk about the Ukraine for a moment. I mean, the dangerousness of the whole situation. The West is now escalating. They're like boiling the frog. They are allowing the Ukrainians to use Western weapons to attack targets within Russia. What do you think? Where is the red line of Vladimir Putin?
Well, the red line is a strategic threat. President Putin was very explicit about that last week. He said, if we have long-range missiles coming, striking in the inside of Russia, that means Western space surveillance, Western programming of these missiles. That means that that's an attack by the United States, essentially, on Russia. If it's Ukrainians sending in drones, we don't like it and we're going to hit back. But if it's the United States using its space technology, its advanced digital technologies, attack missiles or Taurus missiles, it's all the same, basically. This is Western alliance technology that is strategic, that threatens a first strike attack, nuclear attack. That's a red line for us. President Putin wasn't even vague about that and spelled it out quite explicitly, quite formally. If you need programming from satellites, if you try to take out our early warning systems, which there were two attacks against
They tried.
Russian radar
Yeah,
that
by
are
the Ukrainians, they tried
explicitly,
it.
yes. Now, I think the key for the West, so-called, and the West is, just a very small group of people. We don't mean the public, but the thing for the public to understand, and for the West to understand, if you will, and for our leaders to understand, the Ukrainian leaders will have no self-control at all. For them, hit anywhere, raise it to World War III. For them, that makes sense. That's true of the Baltic states also. surprise, I mean, it's not really true, but that's how these leaders think. Raise any level of rhetoric, be as obnoxious as possible. Say Russia, you know, to hear the Estonian leaders say Russia should become smaller states, or Latvian leader, Russia must be defeated. Are you kidding? These are coming, but why are they saying that? Because they want to draw the US into a larger conflict, defeat Russia. This is completely reckless. And the point is, these countries don't have any self-control. It's like Israel too. They will never self-limit because they think they can provoke the United States into backing them with a full nuclear arsenal. But this is a kind of insanity. And this is why the job of the US president is so essential. The job of a US president is to put a foot on the brakes. That's the job.
And is the situation more dangerous than in 1962 in the Cuban Missile Crisis right now?
It is approaching comparability. I would say during that crisis, that was the height that we've ever had of nuclear risk. People don't know the story by and large, but even after Kennedy and Khrushchev had negotiated, and this is very important, negotiated a peaceful outcome that saved the world, a disabled nuclear sub almost launched a nuclear tipped torpedo that would have led to nuclear war, even without the leaders of the two countries provoking it or approving it. You see, we live in a world where there are field forces, there are field commanders, there are generals, there are hotheads, there are all sorts of people in this world, and we need to stay far away from the red lines of the others. This is the main point. This is the perfect vocation for Ukraine. Be neutral. Stay safe, be neutral, and keep the US and Russia apart from each other. Of course, the United States hates the idea of neutrality. This is the basic problem. The US says you're either with us or you're against us. The whole idea of neutrality is against the US doctrine.
But how do you explain the behavior of the Europeans? I'm talking to a lot of politicians, former politicians, and they are crazed. They say they can't believe it. I mean, because Europe will be the battlefield of this confrontation. Europe, which has been destroyed twice in the last century, you can say, so to say, first politically and then really after the Second World War. We don't have to get into that. How do you explain the behavior of the European powers, France, Germany, Brussels? I mean, they're totally in line with this American foreign policy. What's
Yeah,
happening in Europe?
it's so interesting. First of all, when Tucker Carlson had his interview with Putin, President Putin says, "I can't understand the Germans." Okay, if he can't understand the Germans, who can understand the Germans in this case? There is a mystery to this that is not me alone. Now, when I say in discussions that I'm a bit mystified by the European lack of intelligent discussion, debate, understanding, and being led by what I know to be a reckless and ignorant US foreign policy, then I get a lot of mail, and I got one this morning from an academic in Europe who said, "Mr. Sachs, I'm telling you, I grew up in the university system in Europe. You could not say a word against the US. There's no open discussion. And so don't expect anything from here." Then I hear from others who say, "Mr. Sachs, you're very naive. There's a lot of big bucks from the US, from the military industrial complex. Why do you think the US has as its military bases in Europe, we're still basically occupied countries." So people offer lots of theories that basically come to the fact that the US has a lot of control. I think there's one thing that we should understand. Of course, I don't understand it fully because by design it's hidden. But the intelligence services play a huge role in foreign policy, huge. The CIA is not an intelligence agency. It is probably the most important foreign policy institution in the United States. It's both an army, it's a foreign policy maker, and so on. When Congress comes to vote for more aid for Ukraine, it's the CIA director that, quote, explains the facts to the Speaker of the House. When you look at a meeting in this in the Situation Room in the White House, as there was a recent meeting, you see Burns talking. He's the CIA director
Remember.
talking, and the President of the United States listening. I don't think it's an accident. When Israel and Hamas are supposed to be negotiating over a ceasefire and hostage release, who goes from the US? Not Blinken, but Burns, the CIA. Who is most influential in Germany in foreign policy? Is it BND? Is it the secret services? In Britain, isn't it MI6 that plays a huge role? We know that there was, after World War II, a network set up among these intelligence services that included private armies, or armies basically of the leadership outside of parliamentary control. I don't want to go way overboard, except to say that a lot of foreign policy is secretively conducted. Very little is transparent. I know about the US scene much more than I do about Europe. But I believe that part of the issue here is that there is a hidden foreign policy that accompanies the public foreign policy.
And there is another problem just listening to you. I mean, this is the revenge, you can say, of the total neglect of the armed forces within Europe. I mean, many politicians start to realize that they don't have anything. They always depended on the United States, that they will send the cavalry if the
That's
heat
it.
goes up, and now they have nothing in their hand. So they're totally powerless. And it's really interesting that within the last 20 years, the sovereignty of Europe has declined immensely. If you think
That's
back
exactly right.
to the Iraq War at that
But
time, Gerhard Schröder, Germany, and Chirac, they still had the guts and the spine to say, no, we don't participate. Now, totally gone.
this is so true and so strange. I mean, van der Leyen is like a US employee. She wouldn't utter a word. A word. I know it. I've seen some of this inside. It's amazing. It's like a wholly owned subsidiary of the United States. Interestingly, I agree completely with Macron that Europe needs strategic autonomy.
But now he does the opposite.
But then he does so reckless. It's just unbelievable the improvisation.
But I had a discussion with some people who were at the time involved in the buildup of the Nord Stream pipelines in Germany, politicians, ambassadors. And there is one thing I would be curious, what's your opinion? I mean, if you look from the national interest of the United States, after the Second World War, I mean, they have fought the Second World War, they have been here, they have their troops here, they have their embassies here. And now they start to see that Germany is drifting towards Russia. There was this huge honeymoon in, 2000, 2008, 2010, Putin and Schröder, close friends. You had the energy lines. And I started to think about the United States. How do they see this? That Germany, this hot bride, this rich bride, is drifting to the east. And then it's geopolitical ice cold interest. The Americans don't want Russia and Germany together because it's not in their interest. They don't want Europe slip under the control, you can say, of Russia. So isn't there a certain rationality on the side of the American aggressiveness in that sense?
I think that this is exactly right, that the idea of Germany and Russia close together is against US foreign policy as perceived by the security state. And it's very interesting. You know, I was an advisor to Gorbachev and an advisor to Yeltsin. And my view was that and of course, as an advisor, I wanted to see a strong economy of the Soviet Union and a strong economy of Russia, just like I like a strong economy of China, because I'm not an us versus them mentality. I want people to have decent lives. Now, my own thought, very vividly, I can remember back to 1991, 92, was you had the Soviet Union had been cut out of Western technology, of course, for decades. That was the whole containment policy and so on. But I thought, well, the real opportunity here is, of course, Germany and Russia joining forces to help rebuild a lot of the industrial base. You have great scientists, engineers in Russia. This is wonderful. That's what I wanted, very explicitly. That's the natural way that this economic region would work. Putting
Exactly.
a border is completely contrary to economic interests. Geopolitical, well, not geopolitical, but to safety, to peace. But that's what the US idea is. So it comes back to the mystery, how does Germany let itself be so suborned in this? Because Germany wasn't looking to connect with Russia to take over the world. It was looking for a natural economic relations.
But
We
what
call
would
it
you?
the gravity model, by the way, in economics, that you trade with your neighbors.
And who is the American politician who would accept this, you could say, natural development? Because you can argue Europe was, except in the Second World War, at the beginning of the Second World War, Europe was always well off when Germany and Russia went along and had a good cooperation. In 1939, it was not the case when Hitler and Stalin made this contract, of course, which is a huge drama. But are there American politicians who would accept that Germany and Russia and Europe and Russia had better relationship, not dominated by the United States, but just like as you described it, are there politicians in the United States who would accept that, or is this
No,
totally against everything?
it's not even an issue of discussion or discourse, because the US, understand, is very narrow-minded. It was flattered in 1941 when Henry Luce, the publisher of Time, said, "This is the American century." Oh, Americans loved that phrase. This is our turn to lead the world. And we're essentially still in that mindset. And so American doctrine, grand strategy, if you want to use that phrase, is full spectrum dominance of the United States in every region of the world, including Europe, of course. And a close German-Russian economic cooperation is against that, actually. And so Nord Stream was the great bugbear of American politics all through the 2010s. When it was destroyed, it was the most predicted event imaginable, because the US had said for a decade, "We'll never let it happen. We'll never let it happen. We'll never let it happen." So what you're saying is absolutely correct. But we don't even rise to that level of sophistication in American politics to be aware explicitly that that's a debatable issue, because the only debatable issue is full spectrum dominance of the United States.
Last point, you have to rush your precious time. Last point, we have this conference in Switzerland. Our newspaper is very alone in the landscape in criticizing this very one-sided conference in the center of Switzerland without Russia being invited, and they also declined. Probably our government will just at the moment when we record this extend an official invitation to Russia, but it's way too late and it's totally clumsy. What do you think about this conference? You've heard about it. Is it good or is it totally bad? Is it destructive for Switzerland, which is perceived as not being neutral? What's your take on that?
It's a joke. How could a serious country like Switzerland fall into such a stupidity? This isn't a peace conference. This is a joke. Peace conference, that's Biden and Putin speaking to each other. Come on, this is a game, and it's a failed game. The whole world said, this is ridiculous. So why would a serious country like Switzerland fall into such an unserious venture? I really don't know. Switzerland has better things to do with its time, and it should be a serious country. And it is a serious country. And by the way, it showed what neutrality could do and how it could properly host institutions and be serious. But this is not a serious activity from beginning to end.
Jeffrey, Professor Sachs, many thanks for that conversation. Have a great day and let's hope for the best.
You too. We'll talk again soon, I hope. Yes. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.